Hello and welcome to an EdTech Talk discussion of Dave Cormier's Learning in a Time of Abundance. This is Jeff Lebo in Busan, Korea.
My name is Jennifer Magill in Laval, Wisconsin.
My name is John Schenker, and I'm in Stowe, Ohio.
And I'm Dave Cormier. I'm in Windsor, Ontario, Canada.
And we are a gang of old friends and EdTech talkers who haven't been active in a while, but are gathered here to discuss Dave's new book. Today we're going to be talking about his introduction. But since it has been a while, and it is possible that we might have new viewers, well, it's possible we won't have any viewers, but some of them might be new. And in that case, we thought a little background information and introduction of ourselves might be in order. In Dave's introduction, he writes back about the early days of being locked out of a classroom and making the switch from textbook to internet in the late 90s. I was around for those days. I was looking through our old messages and we were exchanging Netscape voicemails. I wasn't able to open them, but I'll download a codec and somehow hopefully figure that out. There were mentions of 6 a.m. Song room outings and whatnot. But anyway, so we've been friends for a very long time. And in 2005, we started this little site called EdTech Talk that blossomed into a community of educators talking about EdTech stuff. I currently teach at a university in Busan, Korea, where I use technology in a variety of ways to torture my students and facilitate learning. That's me. Who are you,
That's
Jen?
you. Yes, I think I was next to the party. I was in grad school. I was getting my master's at the time, and I needed a class project. And so I was a fangirl of EdTech Talk. And so I wrote off and said, "Would you have a need for some assistance on your webcast?" I think it was called at the time, right? Webcast Academy, teaching folks how to use all the tools that were available for folks to do webcasting at the time. And yeah, I got a response back, and then the rest is history. The next I guess we're saying like 19 years, I think, then we've known each other. And I think in person I've only met each of you once, which is still kind of, I think, kind of cool. Maybe Jeff, I've met you twice, maybe. Yeah, I think maybe we did a conference or something. So yeah, very, very close friends who really haven't had a chance to meet so much in person, but spent tons of times every Sunday night, right? For about 10 years plus, we were together. And so in the interim, after that first greeting, I continued my education, finished my PhD. And then I've started a nonprofit in the meantime, and I currently teach at University of Virginia. So that's my story.
And I'm the relative newcomer. I was a listener, started listening to the podcast in 2000, late 2005. And although some of you may differ, I had blogged about the podcast not being quite so groundbreaking, and that I was commenting on Jennifer being a breath of fresh air to the group, and was called out on it. I think the actual words were, "So you think you can do better?" And was drafted to come talk to you guys and make fun of you every day. I'm working in K-12 education for my whole career. This is the end of year 31, where I taught for 6 or 8 years, middle school and high school computer applications and coding, and then have been the guy in charge of technology in public school districts since then. So worked in 4 different school districts now, and I've been in my current one for 4 years. And I'm basically responsible for all things tech, making all of that stuff work. But really, the exciting work is what effect does this have on teaching and learning, and how do we do things with technology that we can't do without it? So that's been my focus for the last 30 years.
So my name is Dave Cormier. I currently work at the University of Windsor as a learning specialist. I have a bit of a, I think of myself as an educational vagabond. I kind of wandered around a bit. I started working as a teacher near Jeff and then eventually kind of close to Jeff. And he did save my tail any number of times the first couple of years I was trying to do this. So I both blame and thank Jeff for starting me down the EdTech path many, many years ago. And for me, this has always been about how the technology changes what it means to learn, like what it means to be in a classroom, what it means to do those things. And through being in, I've done recruitment, retention, communications. I've been an educator. I've done ed tech inside the K-12 system. I've managed a med school for a while. I've done all kinds of different jobs and always sort of peeking around, trying to figure out how the system works and how we can make it a little bit better, maybe. Right now, I teach in the Faculty of Education at my university, and I also help faculty understand how the digital impacts their classrooms. And I just wrote a book.
Which is why we're here.
All right.
You are here.
Segue. That was a
Segue.
segue.
That was beautiful.
Right.
That was beautiful. All right. So, if the guys are okay, are you ready for me to jump in and fire some questions at our good friend Dave?
Please do.
All right. So, Dave, let's start out with the title of the book, Learning in a Time of Abundance. I like the title, but I like the second part better personally. A little editorial comment here. The community is the curriculum. But I think we're going to spend a lot more time, at least in my series of questions. We're focusing in on the introduction, and I don't think we mentioned this, but our plan is to continue this as a weekly installment, going through sections of the book, and we're just kind of starting out slowly here, going through the introduction, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking more about the abundance part of this of your title, if that's okay with you, and you certainly can add some other things to that. But let's start out with a kind of a softball here. You've been a blogger for a long time. We've just kind of gone through your history of being a webcaster. Why a book? And in my questions here, which I gave you a chance to look at, I kind of sarcastically said, were your blog posts too confining? Did you need more space, more words? But yeah, kind of give us the reason why, your motivations. Why did you write the book?
There are probably three things. The first thing is I've always wanted to write a book. I started trying to write one when I was 22. It's still out there somewhere. I tried and failed and started a publishing company with the whole idea that I was going to publish books my whole life. So there's always been this sort of thought in the back of my head that sometime on my to-do list was getting a book written. There's a person at a conference about 5 years ago came up to me and went, "I just can't. It's not enough time. Did you write a book or something?" And I was like, "I suppose I could do that." And literally, that was the whole part of that conversation, and it just stuck with me. Also, I've been trying to explain the same kinds of things for a long time, and I find that it is too confining. The blogs are too confining. I'm afraid to say that. I know you're joking, but I think you're right. I wanted to try. To I've been thrown a number of people's books over the years and gone, "We'll just read this." In that, here's this big concept that somebody is trying to explain and get through it. So I wanted to at least sort of take the work that I've tried to do and the thoughts that I've stolen from all my friends and put them together into one spot so I could sort of say, like, this is the piece I'm trying to, this is what I'm trying to say. And in a way that one could be brought to other people. So like the people who have come back to me and talked to me about the book so far, most of them are not educators. Most of them are not my colleagues. Most of them are just random people in my life that I happen to know at some level who read a book in a way that would have never read a blog post, right? So it reaches another group of people that I would never ever do. And the fifth of my three reasons is that it's on the vague hope that it ends up on a policymaker's desk because my blog is never going to get there. But there's a chance that the book does. And so it's another chance, another attempt at trying to impact the discussion in the field in the ways that I think are important.
Well, we're on the title. I'm just
Yeah,
curious, when did you cement the title? Did you start with it? Did it occur along the way
no.
or at the end?
I had a bunch of different ones. It the Lee Scalaur-Pisett, who you guys might know from, I think it's Times Higher Ed. One of the She's a writer anyway. She works at Georgetown. In Candles. She and I had been talking about this, and I was about 2 months into starting to write the book, and she goes, "What are you trying to talk about?" We went back and forth and back and forth, and I'm like, "Oh, basically it's abundance. That's the thing that I'm actually talking about." And once I had that, I basically had a version of the title. It went through a bunch of variations, and the community as curriculum has been part of it from the beginning. That I always knew that it's the underlying concept of all the work that I've been trying to do. So it's sort of the
Do you
carry
remember any of
forward.
the alternatives?
I have a list of them somewhere. I'll
Okay,
get them
well,
for
we'll
the
put
next
that in the
show.
show notes.
We'll put them in the show notes. Yeah, I have a
All
list of them somewhere. I had
right.
tried them out, and there's a whole bunch of crazy things that were in there, but I'll get them in.
You know what? I'm going to go off script for my next question. I want to loop John in because this is like before we even get to the introduction, there your acknowledgments and very prominently described, you said that John was instrumental in kind of keeping the project moving. At least that's the way I interpreted what you were saying. So, did you have any comments on that? And John, if you wanted to kind of talk about your involvement.
I think he overstated my contributions. I just kept asking when the book is going to be done because I want to buy the book and hand it to people and say, you need to read this. Because I mean, we've known Dave for almost 20 years now. Trying to summarize Dave is really hard to do. It's easier to hand someone a book. So I just kept saying, I need the book. Where's the book? And, do you need me to read a chapter? Do you need me to make some comments? And then he foolishly allowed me to read some of it many times. And gave him some comments, and that created an extra year's work for him. But it was fun to go through that process, especially knowing Dave and knowing what he's trying to say and knowing how he talks and how he blogs. And really, the book is a different voice. It's still very much Dave, but it's a different voice from what you would hear on podcast or what you would read in a blog post. And so it was kind of fun watching that transformation from Dave talking things out and getting them onto the screen, and then watching that become a book was really cool.
In the spirit of keeping traditions alive, John, I don't love your audio.
Really?
Oh, this is so
Oh,
sweet.
that feels good.
This is a warm
It's a
fuzzy.
little tinny, like I'm wondering if you're using the onboard mic, you could
I'd like
lean
to
in
go back
maybe.
like while John is figuring out his audio. He's a bold-faced liar. He did an awful lot on a detailed level, on a day-to-day level. Having somebody who trusts you enough to tell you how bad something is essential for this kind of this kind of project. And there are a bunch of different moments where John was like, no,
First,
you're
is
not,
this any
no.
better
I think so.
audio-wise?
Maybe. What do we think?
Still a little tinny.
Still a little tinny. Oh, okay. That's all of the microphones that I have right here.
Is it an like, are you on a laptop?
Yeah.
I feel like it's using the onboard mic and it's just
It
you're a little
was.
distant.
It was using the onboard mic, and I switched to this mic.
Well,
It
that
is
seems
better.
better. Sounds better.
Yep.
Okay. All right. I was just doing it
Oh,
for, tradition's sake.
this is a blast
Aw,
from the
just like
past.
the
This is
old
great.
days.
Yeah,
Best
right?
thing in
I tried to
the
get the camera as bad as possible too, but
And we should get on the record, do you have pants on?
that's right.
No,
Oh God, I
no,
wish you had
no.
answered
You
that
have
before.
pants
I'm
on. I
going
really
to
wish
be
that's how that
embarrassed.
went.
Pants on.
See, this is
So
what you
John was
get for watching
actually
the video, by the way.
Dave and I met with me making fun of them, right?
That's true.
So I can't be anything. I can't give him any feedback except here's my reaction to the thing that I'm reading. And actually, I do that with a lot of people, and some of them are appreciative of that and very gracious about it, and some of them are really not. But that's all I can do is here, let me read this and look at it through my lens, and I'll let you know what I think, and then you're going to go make of it what you will. So.
Plus, his grammar is really strong, which is actually really helpful as well. Which I didn't know at all, but he's one of those people who has a really good eye for the mistakes of others. Take that however you like. but he did a really nice job of picking out a lot of sort of just badly formed paragraphs and that kind of stuff too. So it was really helpful.
His audio is better. And since we're slow walking this a bit, let's not overlook mom. The dedication is for my mother who still teaches me how to face uncertainty, which implies that this uncertainty is not a new thing, that you have grown
No.
up with uncertainty. Anything you'd like to say to mom?
Yeah, so my mother was my baseball coach and my hockey coach. My mother taught an entire years of hockey players how to stop both ways, but could only do it one way. She taught us all how to do wrist shots in hockey, but didn't know how to do it herself. She fixed my pitching stance, having never pitched in her life. She's one of these people who can just look at a situation, will try hard enough at it, and just beat it until it submits. And in a super optimistic and super positive way. John spent a lot of time around my mother and probably has a sense for what that looks like.
Dave's mom is awesome. Like, Dave's mom and my wife are besties online. And
That's true.
it's hilarious because they met on that one occasion for a weekend, and I think it's more than anything else, Teresa does not care to have filters. And she's going to tell you what she sees and the way it is and what you need to do. And you're going to do it or not. And if you don't, then you're wrong.
Even
So.
if in this case you happens to be the lawnmower, following one phone call, which is just before I wrote this dedication, I got a phone call from my mother and she's like, I had a chat with a lawnmower today. And I'm like, and she goes, I was out and it stopped running while I was mowing the lawn. My father passed away a few years ago. So mom is now taking over all these tasks and learning how not only to drive the lawnmower, but to repair it. So she goes, I had the laptop out on top of the, or I guess iPad out on top of the lawnmower, going through YouTube videos, trying to figure out how to fix it. And it fixed right after I had a serious conversation with it and told it that if it did not fix, I was going to take it back and get another one. And that was the last thing she had to say to it. Apparently, it worked after that. So,
And it worked.
yeah, it
All right, I think we can move on to sentence number two.
All right. All right. Okay. Well, let's circle back to the comments you were making about audience a little bit. And when we, over all the years we did, I'm going to give a little preface to the question. Over the, all the years we did EdTech Weekly, it was very much for an audience of geeks, really. Even I think even just like kind of general educators would have even been a little unsure of what we were talking about. I don't think we always knew what we were talking about. So what is it like kind of that process of writing for a more general audience, yet kind of keeping that same important message that you're trying to drive through that you've been, like you said, talking about for years?
That's a great question. Some of it was I had a couple of people in my head who I was thinking about and trying to explain this to. I think over the years, having started out a lot of my talks talking about French postmodernism and rhizomes and a whole bunch of other stuff, I got to the point where I realized that having to explain everything to someone first so they can understand the context before you can explain something to them, it's not very helpful. So that was the voice I was trying to find for the book was we're talking about a really complex system in education, an extraordinarily complex concept and learning, and then trying to talk to people in their everyday lives for how they've seen this. Because one of the criticisms that I have for a lot of educational theory is it talks about education as if it's removed from life. Well, it talks about learning as if it's removed from life. And education system necessarily kind of is, but we learn all the time, right? So one of the things I talk about in the book, you can learn to be a bad person. Learning is something we do automatically. And I think there's something in everybody's everyday experience where we have a connection to learning. And it was that piece I was trying to reach so that I could provide some context for the overall concept. So it took some work. John and Lori were helpful with that. The editors were helpful with that. And then just I had my sister in my head the whole time, right? She's smart, but she doesn't know anything about the field and she's pigheaded. So I was really trying to convince her.
Has she read the book and what does she think?
She read a draft actually, before it went in. I got very rapid responses. My sister doesn't spend a lot of time in any one issue. She's perfect as a judge, actually, because she can take in all the information, give a ruling, and then move on. And she was the same way with the book. She gave a lot of good feedback, actually. She followed along, so she enjoyed it. She's a bit more straight line and rigid than I am, though. So some of the wandery approaches to education are probably not quite her thing.
I think my comment last week was, I noticed your sentences were very short, and I was very surprised by that. Either you had a really like an editor
No, it was me. It was
it was
very, I very much tried to write that way. I was trying to write in a sort of quick staccato way that made it approachable and sounded and sort of spaced the language out so that it sounded. I've never really thought about this consciously, so if I'm kind of wandering all over the place, I apologize. But I was looking for this sort of conversational tone so that when you read it, you'd kind of be fighting with me in your head the whole time. And that's or agreeing with me or coming out. And it's kind of worked out because I've had like a few dozen people come back to me and talk to me about the book. And I can tell that they were having a whole conversation because some of the stuff they're coming to me with is not in the book. Like there's a whole other piece they're bringing to it too.
In
Which
my mind,
is
I challenged you on this, and then you rebutted with that,
that's
and now I'm
right.
going to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's cool.
All
And did
right.
you say education is separated from real life? Yeah, totally.
I
The
think
system of education.
learning
Can
and
you?
school are separate.
Yeah.
Can you
So,
elaborate on that?
sure. When I talk about education, I mean, I'm not saying this is every definition of education, but the one that I use in the book is that education is when you're talking about the system. So, teachers and schools and curricula and all the rest of that. And learning is the thing that happens to humans. And if you look at just today, we got a new announcement that cell phones are not allowed in schools in Ontario, which they announced 3 years ago too, and 2 years ago too. They keep announcing it. But it's just, there's no way to talk about the way that people learn without the internet anymore. Like it's just not real life. And so having learning happen separately from that, or education happen without that, to me is another one of those cases where we step away from the way people learn in their regular lives, or will work learn in their work lives, or in any of the other parts of their life,
So you're
because
saying
we
that the
have
way
this
the
idea.
education system currently is not necessarily
That's
that it
right.
has to be.
Yeah. I don't think it has to be. I understand that you end up with some structure, like you need to put some structure in place, like kids have to be bussed around places, maybe. There are buildings, and John will tell you that you need to connect wires to things or something. I don't know.
None of
And I
which
mean, you've got to.
necessitates being separated from real life.
It doesn't. It really does. I mean, good teachers have been doing this for generations. I'm not suggesting it doesn't happen in any classrooms. But I know a lot of people who think of, we're just shoving facts into people's heads. And that's what we should be doing, right? That's their perspective. That's what doing your job means. Yeah, which is not the way anybody lives their life.
Got your answer, Jeff?
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
Page
good.
two.
Next question. It's so weird to have a script. Okay, so now let's kind of we got through the learning in the title. Let's work our way through. We don't have to do time, I
We're up
don't
the end.
think. We can skip that. So let's just hop right into abundance. So actually in my notes, I talked about abundance. I interpret that as being abundance of information. So can you kind of take us through, are you speaking of other things besides abundance of information, or what are your thoughts on abundance that you're trying to describe to us?
I fudged that throughout the book. You caught me. So I do, it is definitely information abundance. And the separation between information scarcity and information abundance, I think, is one of those fundamental shifts that's happened to us. I also think there's an abundance of connection as well that goes along with that. So I was talking to a bank manager today about her daughter's cell phone usage. Not sure why this keeps happening to me, but how, and I was saying that, they're in constant contact, and there's something exhausting about that. And there's an expectation that comes along with that. And there's an abundance of connection that comes in with that. That's very, very different than what my childhood was like, right? I spent a lot of time waiting to meet my friends, or having just left my friends, and they don't have that experience. Or they're waiting, and their friends could be connecting, and they're not, right? Whereas when my friends weren't connecting with me, there was no chance for them to do so anyway. So I wasn't in that constant sort of space where I was knowing that I was being ignored, whether they are or not. And I think that abundance of connection, for instance, is another place in which the technologies really changed the way that we interact at a social level. And I think it changes, like there's all kinds of ways that connection changes things. Like there are lots of people now who never actually learn anything for themselves. All they do is ask someone else. Because they're never actually alone, because they'll just, what do I do this? Tick. So yeah, I think that abundance spreads out, but it's all about the way that the digital sort of provides and over provides, as the case may be.
Yeah, and one thing that I really walked away was this idea that it is a new reality. It's more than just having information, because we've had, especially now, like we've had decades where we have Wikipedia where people were, we're kind of freaked out by that and what does that
They
mean?
still
And
are.
we
They
still
still are.
are, right? And Google will let you go off into all kinds of different directions and tangents, but I think you're really the way I interpret it again is like really like now that we do have a new reality where
Yeah.
this is just, we were kind of joking before we signed on that, we've been doing this 20 years. Some folks haven't even maybe weren't even born that are now going to be teachers pretty soon. But so what folks who are, have grown up with this and now this is their reality. You want to speak to that at all? Like how you framed that? Because I think that was mentioned several times in the introduction that it's like our new reality.
Yeah, I think the ways, like, there's a bunch of examples in there where we talk about how, like, I talk about going to the doctor and how being a doctor has changed so much in the last, because I'm basing that on like the 10 months I spent in med school. But I talked to a lot of doctors, and this was a conversation I kept bringing up. And like, especially for emergency doctors, the experience is so different. You know, people come in and go, I have this. And then often, usually, they're wrong, or at least partially wrong, or kind of wrong, or right, but don't understand the context, or whatever that is. And so they don't have the authority they used to have. There are other ways in which them lacking that authority is probably okay, because there are ways in which no doctor can know everything. And I think there are certainly doctors who took advantage of that, that sort of one way, one directional sort of approach to information, right? They had it and they could withhold it or give it when they wanted to. But our experience with doctors has fundamentally changed in that way. The power structure has changed. The ability of people to find out about things and coming in with those different perspectives has really changed. And because now, if you have a feeling, you can spend 4 hours on a variety of websites discussing what that feeling might be. And so any of these oper and then all of the Facebook reels or Instagram reels or TikToks or whatever you happen to do will all start getting filled with whatever that is, thereby reinforcing whatever it is, whatever dark hole you've gone down. It's because the abundance comes at you from all these different ways. So you've had this thought, you jump in as you jump into the internet and start finding out about it. And then you start getting remarketing on Facebook from some company that sells pills for that. And then like it all comes at you, right? And we're just, there's nothing that we've done to prepare us for that.
Yeah,
And we don't
okay.
have any tools.
And so one thing I don't think you mentioned this in your example that you drew from your from the introduction with the doctor example. I think it also comes into play in terms of what does a doctor need to learn when they
All
have
right.
at their disposal, an iPad or whatever it is that they're standing in front of the patient with. So how now making this kind of segue now getting into thinking about from an educational standpoint, from a learning standpoint, we spent countless weeks on our prior years of webcast talking about what it means to learn and how we should be teaching and what it means to be a good learner. So kind of helping us for, to foreshadow what you're going to be talking about in subsequent chapters of the book, how does an abundance of information impact these issues I just mentioned, both positively and negatively. Just kind of throw some at us just to kind of give us a sense of how this is covered in the book.
And just to add to that question, in the book, you talk about the disdain patients might have for a doctor who's using his phone to look something up. And my reaction was, no, I'd actually have disdain for a doctor who's not using AI or not using tools. And I don't know if I'm a typical patient or not, but just
You are
that was
not.
my thought related to that question.
Well, but then are you disagreeing with the doctor if they land on a different site from the one that you went to, and so they determine that you actually don't have cancer?
Ultimately, I want them to have reliable medical GPT that they
Right?
can use.
I'm not sure reliable fits with all those other words, but we can that.
That's in another chapter, I think
We're getting ahead of
that. That's
ourselves.
chapter
Just
eight.
the fact that we've come up with four different ways of looking at this to me is indicative of the problem, right? So whatever way you look at it, like we all have these different the relationships we have with doctors used to be pretty set. Right, you'd go to the doctor would tell you what was wrong, or they wouldn't because they didn't know, but then you were done. You could get a second opinion, and we have that sort of cultural idiom that's out there about getting a second opinion, but that involved you going to a doctor and having them tell you whether or not you had something wrong with you. That was the whole relationship. We couldn't have opinions about which way it should work, right? And that's where, when you look at the way that I haven't answered your question yet, Jen, but that's because we were distracted by these other comments.
We
And
have
I've
an
heard you, and
abundance
I'm
of
coming back to
questions.
it. We have an abundance of questions. So I think that that's another thing we have to worry about, right? And I think part of the whole landscape here, and I didn't say a lot of this in the book because I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think a lot of the landscape here of anxiety here is about how many choices people need to make. And you don't just make the decision to go to the doctor. You have all these other contexts around how you go to the doctor. What do I want from them? What do I expect from them? What's this relationship going to be? What do I need to read before I get there? How much do I trust this person? Should I go to that? And that doesn't even mention alternative medicine and all this other stuff that's out there around people's health as well. To go back to Jen's question, which is going to be restated by Jen, I hope. So I'm actually getting it right. Yeah. I had it in my head there for a minute. Just... And just...
No, so yeah, you know, we're kind of talking generally about abundance of information. You use the doctor example, and so I was saying,
how do they learn?
Yeah, so how do they learn? How do we teach? What does it mean to be a good learner? Which I think is kind of I have a whole section on all of these topics, but just kind of as a preview of kind of how you frame these things within the book. What were some of your general thoughts?
I want to drop a couple of pieces of context here. Most of the cognitive science literature around how we should teach will tell us that we should really focus on background knowledge before we get into any higher level thinking. Like, you need the background knowledge before you can do anything else. That setup for learning is a setup for experts, right? So that's me learning about science so I can get a PhD in that kind of science. It doesn't work for any of the rest of us who don't become experts in whatever field we're learning. Because then we may learn, like, maybe John has used a lot of calculus in his life, but I have not. And we learn all these things with the expectation that we might take that pathway to expertise, but there's an opportunity cost there of deepening our knowledge on things that we might actually use. And because of that, they're looking at the success of chess players, for instance. So if you're developing a good chess player, they need to memorize everything so they can have all of the moves in their head, so they can see all the moves, right? Closed idea. It's a game with ways to win and lose. But those are the models that that end of the field would want us to follow, right? Because they're looking to build the scientists of tomorrow. Whereas I don't think our particularly K-12 schools are in the business of preparing our scientists for tomorrow. I'd like them to do good with citizens who can make good decisions on regular everyday things. So saying that, I don't think our education system should be designed overall to make doctors. We do that in doctor school. So the thing I have to say about doctor school doesn't necessarily apply to everything else, is the point I'm trying to make. But doctor school, I don't know why I love saying that so much, but I really do, there's a whole lot of sort of facty business that you need to put into your head according to the way that the system is set up. Though most of them are moving towards a competency-based approach rather than a fact-based approach. So all medical schools all around the world are making that transition. We have traditionally said, you need to learn this background knowledge. Now, the truth is, it's this background knowledge amongst this much knowledge. And the small amount that I can show you in 2 years, which is in Canada at least, the amount of time you spend before you go and do your first placement, is maybe the same size, but the overall size of what's available has expanded exponentially around it. So while we could do it the same way, what we're going to find is doctors increasingly need to go beyond that basic knowledge to be able to answer the sort of day-to-day questions that they're dealing with. So that's not to say that, go ahead.
Instead of a year three med student knowing 1% of all of the stuff they now know 0.001%, because you can't keep them in med school for 100 years.
That's right. Which is not to say that there aren't definitely skills that we should just train people to do. So I'll give you an example. I bought a lot of pig's feet while I was at the med school. You buy them in bulk, you put them in the freezer, and the students take them out, put slices in them, and use them to practice suturing. There's no other way around learning how to suture but suturing. And there are lots of skills in the med school that you should definitely just friggin' practice until you get it right. I have a terrible stitch in this left hand from when I put a chisel into my hand 2 years ago, which will tell you that there's at least one med student who did not learn how to stitch.
In all fairness, that was your mom.
It was not. So I'm not saying there aren't skills you should train. I'm saying that overall, we're getting a smaller and smaller subset of what's overall available. Doesn't mean there aren't core skills. It doesn't mean there aren't, there are people who would argue against me, but I still think memorizing things like times tables is useful. I think there's a subset of things that are just useful to memorize. It's just an understanding that that subset is not going to help you with life as much as it would have 50 years ago. So,
What will?
and I've, oh, so imagine like learning with the abundance, right? So what we need to learn how to do. So, and again, using the everyday example here of the heat pump that I bought for my house in December, my furnace stopped. I've been kind of thinking about trying to change the way my house gets heated, but I had vaguely thought about it. And then suddenly I have like 6 hours to try to make a decision. And trying to pull in enough information and sift through all of the marketing that's involved and try to understand where I'm being misled, where there are bad actors who are trying to influence me. And then eventually, at some point, there's no right answer. You just have to decide. That's what real life looks like. And I think the more we do that in our classrooms, the more we help our students with scaffolding and structure and feedback on how they make decisions about how they learn, the more they're going to be prepared for dealing with all this abundance.
And the kind of navigating their way through, like I'd rather have a doctor who's really good at finding the connections he needs to make to diagnose me than someone who can suture well, because eventually they're going to be using the Sutrotron 300 that does it perfectly every time. But I
Yeah, I
want him to
mean,
be able to find the information, connect to the expert, have AI analyze my x-rays or whatever to get the best outcome.
what's interesting you say that because there's a lot of the stuff they teach is about flowchart decision making. So when you look at if I don't know if there are any House fans, but it's Never Lupus, but they have a way of at like you do a test and that test breaks off this part of flowchart. You do a test that fr breaks off this part. So that you slowly whittle down from what it could be based on what you're seeing through testing to what it might be. And it's not accurate. I mean, anybody who's been to the doctor with something that isn't visibly broken will tell, like, it's often a journey, but it's all flowcharts. So a system, it doesn't have to be AI, actually. It just could be like a literal algorithmic system that just sort of helps you down the flowchart. And they're kind of using that anyway. The AI part scares me a little more than it scares you, Jeff.
But like, haven't
Again, with
studies
those.
shown that AI is better at analyzing a lot like x-rays or different medical tests? And it's early on. I mean, you've got to think that's going to get better.
I mean, I'm sure there are tasks that it can do better. I think what, again, those back of the napkin conversations with the doctors would tell me is that if they had the chance of knowing everything or convincing their patients to do what they were told, 100% of them chose convince my patients to do what they're told, which is not something the AI system's going to do. So to me, I think the identification part is important, but it's really not the job unless
Which
you're a
implies they
surgeon.
should be learning more social skills and negotiation skills.
I would love that. That'd be fantastic. And actually, those courses don't go over very well inside the med schools, as I understand it, certainly in the med school I worked in and others I've talked about, because those kids have been brought up, they're the ones who got 100 on everything, right? They're the ones who've been rewarded for getting everything right, for having the right answer to the question. And so you bring them into the socialness of medicine class, and suddenly they're like, what do you want me to do? What's the question? What's the test? How do I get 100 on this? So the idea of exploring their field, like not all of them, there's some amazing students that I work with who were more than ready to jump on that journey, but a lot of them were not. That's hard to teach too.
Kind of raises the question of expertise, which I think might be the next question.
It is. You guys just keep teeing up these segues for me. Yeah. So this is a bit of a pivot
Wow.
to kind of drilling down now in the additional themes that were covered in the intro that we can let you riff on a little bit here as a preview. But yeah, if we had all this information out there, kind of to what Jeff was saying, like who put it there and like who's the expert that put it there and how do we measure expertise? How do we fact check? How do we determine what are our trusted sources. So, how does that play into your book and what we're going to be hearing in future chapters?
I think that's the hardest. I mean, and we've, I think at some level, we've always done this badly. So, like, when I was in high school, I was told to look at the publisher and the city the publisher was from, and somehow that was relevant. But nobody ever explained to me why. or how I was supposed to decide whether or not it was a publisher who I should trust. Like, how would I know that anyway? I can understand its validity to people who are already experts, and ChatGPT is a perfect example. ChatGPT is great if you're already an expert in the topic you're searching. Man, it pulls stuff together fast, and you're like, you go through it and you're like, nope, this is good, that's fine, nope. And you can go through it and you can pull it out and you've got a document ready and you're good to go. Right? It's great in that sense. If you're, it's just filling in the typing and putting it together in a structure that's tidy, and then you can kind of edit and you go along. I think the internet's the same, right? So if you're already an expert, then you're not going to get tricked by all of these things that take you outside of that context. Most of us, all of us are not expert at something. Most of us are not expert at anything. And so that puts you in a really bad position. If your only tool is using expert tools to evaluate everything and you ain't got them, then it's a free for all, right? So there's really great methods out there for fact checking. Certainly the SIFT method that Michael Caulfield pulled together is the one that people point to the most. And that's fine if the thing you're looking for has a right answer. But if it's how do I impact poverty in my home city? Which are real life questions that I would love for us to be more worried about in our schools. I mean, we do projects. Certainly, my kids have come home with projects they've done and stuff like that. But they're projects that have right answers inside the school that get graded for getting the right way, even though we know those don't work inside of our cities.
Yeah, and I think the third part of what I was mentioning or asking about was the expert expertise and fact checking, but the trusted sources piece.
Yeah.
We went through that with COVID. Like, where are
Right?
we getting our information? We used to get our parents' generation listened to like Walter Cronkite every now we're listening to Joe Rogan or a countless number of
Or
other
I hope we
podcasters. Like,
aren't,
who do
are we?
we? Who do we get our information from and who do we trust? Yeah.
Yeah, and
Except that.
this foreshadows for later, but the whole idea of research, like I did my research, is just. It's every time I hear it now, it gets terrifying. I always sit with my students, I always force them to go, did you search or did you research? Like, let's just
Yeah.
calm down a little bit here. Research is something you can do if you have expertise. Searching is what you're doing without it. And there are definitely ways of searching better or worse. And there are sources that I trust, but they're based on my values, right? So I think mostly the New York Times does a reasonable job. There's a whole swath of people in your country who do not believe that. Right. And for them, that newspaper doesn't reflect their values. And
Part of
it's
that
not
is the
about truth, it's
abundance
about
of
values.
sources too. In the mid 20th century, you have three news sources. So as long as they're all on the same page, that is truth because that's the only source you have. I think now with this many voices, it's like having two watches. You're never really sure what time it is. And the more voices we have, the more opportunities there are for people to attack any single one of those because they disagree with it.
And there's more people to be in the vacuum of people who believe the thing that you're believing,
Yeah.
right? So I always think of flat earthers who are amongst the most mysterious of groups to me, because I can't imagine how you can live on a round planet and think it's flat. But they do. And there's enough of them to all convince each other that they do. And there's enough of that sort of group thing to pull it together. And there are enough people out there who will say, don't trust authority. And of course, sometimes you should not trust authority. It's a complex situation, but
Well, I guess too, that's that abundance of connection because they can find each other in ways that
that's
they
right.
couldn't 20
Yeah,
years ago.
for sure.
I'm
Where do you think?
terrified of the current misinformation landscape,
Oh
but
yeah.
part of me is a little bit optimistic, like answering how do I deal with
Always
poverty in my
is.
town?
He's so
I
optimistic. I
feel
know.
like there's the
So
potential
great.
for the tools to analyze, like, this is how a million different communities have dealt with it. And these are the outcomes. And here is some neutral analysis that is based on data. Now, how you choose to accept that data is, going to be related to values and what you want to hear. But like the potential to get not the answer, but useful neutral information exists or will exist, won't it?
I would argue that it won't. I mean, I can't tell you that it won't, but certainly that's the dream of the meta study, right? So if I take 800 studies, so John Hattie is famous for writing a book about 800 studies about education, right? It's the classic massive meta study. I've looked at so many versions of education. I can tell you what improves learning the most. The problem is each one of those 800 studies has measured learning slightly differently in a slightly different context, that when you put them together, the ideas don't, that it doesn't, they would argue that because I've done lots of them, it levels out, which is true if the thing you're counting is a counting noun. So if you do 800 mega studies on the number of mosquitoes in a community, right? There's an actual number of mosquitoes. You could count, maybe you can't, but there is an actual number, right? There's a real fact that you can find out. And people's ability to study those mosquitoes are going to balance out, and then you're going to get a number that works out. If you don't believe that learning can be counted, which I don't, then you're not measuring learning. You're measuring the way a test measures people's recall of something that happened in a classroom with a random person in front of them. So you're not actually, and that's the same thing with poverty. The thing you're going to have to measure is going to be what? The number of people
Policy
who go to a.
actions given certain variables and resulting outcomes.
But the messiness is on all the things that you didn't tell me. So at some level, are you counting the number of people who go to a community food place? Because if you are, that might be indicative of the community food places working well, or it might be indicative of the fact that there's more poverty in that city. So the measurement you take doesn't give you that information. It's a number you can count, but it doesn't have the context to it. Right? That's the problem with a meta study, is at some level, if the thing you're meta studying is recovery rates for people to be able to go back to running after they have a meniscus tear, at some level, there's a real number in the world that tells us whether or not someone ran again after a meniscus tear, which is why we do a lot of meta studies in the sciences and in medicine. But when you talk about poverty, it's not, I can't have seven poverties. I can have number of people below the poverty line, right? And I can measure whether or not they're getting a certain amount of money. They can kind of do that, but then you're measuring money, you're not measuring, you know what I mean? Like it's always
Yeah, you know,
the
it's not going to be perfect, but I feel like there's still, even in qualitative matters, useful information that can be gained. Not a definitive decision, but, you know, on a smaller level, it's
Sure.
okay, neighboring community A did this and neighboring community B did that, and A worked better. Okay, that's my meta study.
So it
But
worked
you
better.
put,
That ends up
I
being
think,
hard to
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Okay. And just to like step back, just a tip.
Where's your common sense, young man?
No.
You
So
know it when you see it.
In my dissertation, one of the things I looked at the measures of the community of inquiry. So it's perceptions of students looking at their cognitive presence, social presence, and teaching presence against a learning outcome. So when you look at, as Dave's saying, at the vast number of people who've looked at the community of inquiry, they look at learning in terms of learner perception. And some of the measures almost look like satisfaction. Some of them are tests, some of them are GPA, some of them are completion, some are persistence, but they're still calling it in some way, shape, or form learning. And so when we did ours, we had definitions for perceived learning and we had definitions for an objective measure, meaning something that the teacher gave. There was no correlation between the learner's perception of whether they learned and an objective measure of the teacher. There just was none. However, there was almost a perfect correlation between satisfaction and perceived learning. So here, all these studies are out there studying perceived learning. They're studying satisfaction. And it had nothing to do with whether some of the we had three measures of objective measures of learning, and one of them was the teacher saying, basically, from your gut, do you feel this person can walk out in the world and do what you taught them to do in this class? Like, will they be able to do what the objective measures that you were attempting to teach them in this class? And again, like there was no correlation
Did you
between
control
that.
that number for gender?
Oh, we probably did. Yeah, it's
Because I'd
probably
be
in the
really curious
former,
to know
yeah.
how much that differs by gender, whether or not the dudes in the class are like, yeah, I taught them great and they'll be fine, and whether or not there's a
Yeah, but to kind of, I hopefully that kind of ties into what you're saying, and Jeff, to kind of answer your
Totally.
question, like what they everybody in all these prior studies that we were you kind of had in our lit review, they all said that they were examining learning, but then when you really kind of drill down to it, their measure of learning was all over the place.
Has the age of abundance made this more difficult to solve poverty? Like, I don't feel like we had great answers before, and now because of the abundance, it's harder. I feel like if anything, we've got at least more data, even if it's not totally reliable and it's wonky in some ways.
There's two answers to that. First, like Riddle and Weber from the 70s would tell you that that's asking the wrong question, that you can't solve for something like poverty because it's a wicked
Well, he's
problem.
not
You
on
can
the show, and
only
it's our show, and we get to ask whatever question we
deal with a,
want.
you can only deal with a small part of any one of these problems. And asking the big question is always the thing that gets you into trouble, because you can't solve it because we can't even agree on what it is. I think that the more the extra data helps in some cases, and in other cases, it just like when I look at education specifically, it's a nightmare because every single person who wants to make an argument can pull out a paper to support that argument. They can pull out 20 papers. They can pull out 100 papers to support whatever random position they might have. Like I play this game with my students all the time, right? Where I'll come up and I'll give them one side of an argument and say, "Oh, go look for this," and then I'll give them the other side, and they're like, "We just read all this unbiased, objective literature that said that this was true." And then we go and they're like, "Well, this all says that it's false. How can, like, what's the right answer?" And the answer, of course, is that I don't know if there's a right
Welcome to
answer.
Dave's class.
Right on the day's class. I don't know what's wrong. You just still have to decide what you're going to do in your
Drop
class.
flips you over there.
Yeah. But that's the problem with abundance, right? Is that anything, it's the Joe Rogan thing, right? Like, if you're looking for a reason to have someone not mask, you can find one study somewhere that proves one thing. And then a bunch of people will know that they're going to get attention by following up that study with another one. So somebody else is going to make one. And suddenly you have 20 studies that all go, were based on what happened in like the flaws in one man. I'm making this part up now, but the flaws in one manufacturer's mask technique that's been extrapolated to all masks, or takes the idea of masking out of context. Or claims that if someone wears a mask, somebody else can still get sick, which is of course true. It's that it reduces it statistically and it has a statistical impact on the population is the point, but that's a subtle point. It's boring. But with abundance, you can find somebody to contradict that. I'm sure we could pull up a paper that totally contradicts what I just said. That's the problem. And everybody can find it. And so if you're only looking for the things that support your existing position, you can find that. Whatever that
Well, I'm going to
position
keep hope alive and see if it lasts until chapter
That's why we love you so
so good.
much. All right, so we've got about under 10 minutes here, so I'm going to tee up one last theme for you that runs throughout the book, and you said actually runs throughout your career and your life when we spoke last time, was uncertainty. So describe how all of this relates to uncertainty.
So I feel bad for the student who's this story is about because I've told it 1,000 times, but it really was the starting point for me. So I had a student who came up to me in the second week he was working for me and he went, "Dave, I have to apologize to you." And I said, "Oh." And he goes, nice student, no reason to, nothing had just happened. And he goes, "You've been asking for my opinion for the last week and a half, and I assumed you were lying because no adult's ever asked me a question without already knowing the answer." That to me describes the way we've developed our education system, right? We have a system where, for lots of reasons, we tell students that questions have answers. And their job as students is to discover the answer that the person in front of me already knows. So it's just a hiding. So I have the answer, I'm hiding it from you, and your job is to figure it out. That's sort of the game that we're playing. And then like my friend, the bank manager, who I was talking to today, who is saying that she's increasingly finding that there are a lot of people who she's interviewing and who she's trying to train, who once they meet up, they run into a situation where their judgment is required, where they have to make a decision, they just freeze, right? And we've seen this in my conversations with the social work program, with the law program, and a whole bunch of other people, where that ability to confront uncertainty is the thing that the students are struggling with the most. I don't blame this generation. I think that all of the things people have to decide all the time are partially to blame for this. I also think that we've increasingly structured our education system to be analytic so that we can get data, that we can test it, so we can check to see if people are performing. And we've been forcing ourselves increasingly in that direction, and that has a huge impact on the way we think of learning, because we think of learning as getting the right answer. But most of life is not like that. Like, most of the decisions we make, should I have a cookie right now? I'd be really happy if I had a cookie. I could really like one.
But we get stuck. We get stuck trying to come up with the right answer. And it's just like, I mean, we're doing some traveling this year and several overnight flights, and we need neck pillows for sleeping on a plane. So my wife ordered 12 of them and said, we're going to try all of these and we're going to return the ones that we don't want.
Course she did.
And they're sitting in a box, on the other side of this wall. And somehow I have to come up with a way of evaluating these 12 different neck pillows now, because reading the online reviews just wasn't enough. And when
But online
every
succeeds.
my kids struggle with that, right? Because every decision they make is, they have to be right. And there's so many variables and so many factors that they just get paralyzed by that.
And you know who tells you what's right? Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan tells you if something's right. And
Yeah,
to me, that's the appeal, right?
cuts to the chase.
It's
Yeah.
the certainty.
The
Yes.
certainty
Yeah.
and the way it's
ChatGPT does
communicated.
that too.
Yeah. Oh, that's a
Very,
huge,
it sure
very
does.
confident. Totally.
And it apologizes, unlike Joe Rogan, it apologizes when you call it.
But I think that's the keystone, right? If we prepare you for certainty and then you don't find it, then you look for something that is certain. And you've had other demagogues in your country whose names I won't even mention, who've made their business on just telling people the truth, even if it's patently the opposite thing that that person said 2 months ago. It doesn't matter, as long as it tells me what I should do, right? Because I'm accustomed to that kind of, and it I think we're training ourselves into that. I think it's a Pavlovian problem here, where I
While we're
think.
talking about neck pillow consumption and demagogues, one of my
Goodness, man.
takeaways, one of my takeaways from the introduction is that, wow, this book doesn't seem particularly about education or technology. It seems more about societal systems and moral values. And like you talk about, I feel like there's this underlying tone about the corporate interests and marketing. You talk about the evolution of marketing. What is the difference between Instagram feeding me ads of minimalist hiking footwear or hair regrowth, which I find ageist and insulting because I've never searched for that, but it still gives it to me, versus Edward Murrow
Amazing.
selling cigarettes on his newscast?
Right. What's the difference?
I got the sense that part of this transformational thing is that this has changed the where the role corporations are playing in marketing. Is playing is has changed, but has it? Or how so?
I mean, yes and no. The technology that we have shapes the things that people can do. So if you look at Bernays, who designed some of those ads, he understood radio before everybody else did. He understood that having a trusted voice could sell something way better than anything else, and that having a slogan spoken and even written, and there's a lot of that sort of text marketing as well, could make things true, right? That if we get a slogan, if we put that together, the thing that we're saying becomes the truth. So the example I use in the book is the diamond wedding ring that has to be 2 months' salary. It's just something somebody made up and then did a bunch of ads for it. And TV was really good for that because you get the same thing everywhere. It's like you were saying earlier, where there's only three channels. So there's only three news networks. And so they all say the same thing. Then it's the same with this, right? If the ad says the same thing everywhere afterwards, it starts to become part of the truth. Now, little things can become like that and they're increasingly hidden, right? So it's not an obvious ad. Have these lucky strikes and you can be as smart as I am. Right? It's built into 27 paid TikTokers plus the 3,000 people who are unknowingly copying those 27 paid TikTokers and are spreading it without being paid because they don't even realize that they're part of the marketing campaign. And it's coming in subconsciously, right? You're not seeing it in the same ways. It's hidden in all kinds of ways. Plus, instead of you getting marketed to, through the, I won't go too far back, during the commercials at Jeopardy, which brings everybody in, So that when you walk away from the television, you're no longer being marketed to in your house. Now you're being marketed to at every part of the place, right? Every time you try to do anything, you get hit. So I think it's the same thing they're trying to do, which is make money, but there's so many more tools and so many more ways of getting it done and so many more ways of slipping it in.
So that's the technology. What about the corporate and governmental systems? Have they changed or they're
Wow, some of
always?
them have. So if you look at the information firms in Macedonia, like holy baby, there are people who can be hired to do almost any to push forward almost any agenda. And there are certainly governments, Jeff, you'll remember, who have approached some of your material even back in the 90s. You had some server problems based on some government influences back then. So it's not like that's brand new. Like the internet's always had some of that. I think it's gotten more complex. I think increasingly there are anybody who is trying to convince you of something. So I don't want to make this sound tinfoil hat conspiracy like. To put it in plain language, to finish up by doing the thing that Jen said I claimed to do in the first place. If your job was to try to convince somebody of something, wouldn't you use the internet? And governments are in the business, in some cases, of trying to convince people of something. A lot of that, and certainly in my country, I'll speak for mine, is good. They're trying to convince you to sort your garbage properly so more of it gets recycled. It's still being marketed. It's still like, what's the economics term? The nudge marketing. Like, there's all that stuff that's happening. They're trying to do good. I'm just saying that not all governments are trying to do good at the same time and in the same. Some of them are not trying to do
Or
good
does
at
good
all.
mean the same thing to everybody?
To all people, fair enough. Thank you for giving us the positive note there, Jeff.
Well, that's not particularly positive. I think that's the
More positive than
challenge.
what
Is,
I said.
I mean, because you talk about trying to make positive changes, but that's going to mean a lot of different things to different people.
All right.
Yep.
We'll have to
Expertise and
find out in the
opposite
next
services.
chapter.
We'll have to
Yes.
find out in the next installment
Cool.
of Finding the
Change has
Primary
never been a
Weapon.
bargain. Chapter
This
one.
is very good.
All right, I think we brought it right to the end of the hour. Nice job. Any other questions we missed that from the introduction?
Did you check the chat room? See if anybody put any questions in?
Oh yes, we've forwarded them all.
Okay, good. Good. Just want to make sure we don't miss anybody.
And I'd
Good
like
job,
to thank
Jen. That's
our viewer, who is
good.
probably one of us, but we will be back, I think, next week to talk about chapter one, the same time. And if anyone is watching this, thanks.
Yeah,
And if not,
cheers.
had a great
Thanks,
discussion
guys.
anyway.
Yeah.
I
bet we sold copies.
We'll
Fill in the blank.
have to work on our marketing techniques.
Gotta work on our marketing
That's right. Got to get a
plan.
TikTok version of this.
All right. And all of our viewers, stay tuned for the post show. Otherwise, see you next week.